Good afternoon and welcome along. Thank you for choosing Premier Christian Radio. And my thanks to Megan for I Choose. She'll be back again at the same time next week. Don't forget that Dave and B are here with Hip Rock UK between 4 and 6 o'clock this evening. Well, we've got another great program for you today as we continue to chat to American masters of apologetics and Christian thinking.
You're unbelievable.
And on the program today, Alvin Plantinga. He is a noted philosopher. He has been published around the world. He's really been a leader in the field in terms of thinking about God, particularly the problem of evil when we think about God. The fact that, you know, how can an all-good, all-loving God, all-powerful God allow evil? Well, Alvin believes he's found some pretty powerful answers to those kinds of questions, and we're going to be hearing from him in the course of the program. We'll be introducing him a little bit later on here on Unbelievable. Well, thank you for being with us. Now, as I say, Alvin will be our guest shortly, but right now I'd like to introduce a guest who was with me some time back. Well, it's my pleasure to have joining me on the programme this afternoon, John Andrews. John, you may remember, if you've been a long-time listener to Unbelievable, joined me over a year ago now here on the programme, just at this introductory section of the programme, to tell us a little bit about, you know, his experience of the Alpha course, which he had been on and was going through at that time. And I seem to remember, John, you saying at the time that you were finding it interesting, that you were learning a lot.
It was very fascinating, yeah.
Yeah, and a year on, or more than a year on,
yeah,
sort of, where would you say you are now in terms of faith and spirituality?
Well, I've actually done two Alpha courses at two different churches, and it's been sort of a way to basically sort of, you know, open my eyes a bit, because I always have been a Christian, but you know, when you sort of get to a certain age, you know, 13, 14, you sort of drift away from it a bit. And the Alpha is sort of just a way of getting back into it, you know. So through that, started going to church regularly and getting involved with church life, church community, and I think, you know, I'm more of a sort of more spiritual,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, and in a sense committed to church in a way that you weren't before.
Yeah, because it now seems like, you know, I wake up on a Sunday morning and think, yes, I go to church, rather than sort of thinking, oh no, can't be bothered sort of thing, you know, perhaps I would have done before.
I mean, a lot of people go on the Alpha course. Not everyone sort of chooses to make a decision or a commitment to faith. I mean, would you describe that as what happened to you? You say you kind of felt like you were a Christian before. Did it kind of deepen your faith? Did it make you realise more about it?
It did. I mean, I already know. It was all sort of in my mind, but it sort of just brought it to the front of my mind, really. I was able to sort of, you know, bring things to the front of my mind and, you know, sort of just realise, you know, perhaps, you know, beliefs and thoughts that were there, but not sort of hidden.
Yeah. Do you feel like, as a person, you've changed in the course of doing the course and, you know, a year on, would you say?
Yeah, I think I'm more, I try and lead more of a Christian life now, you know, helping other people and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing, I suppose, is perhaps before doing Alpha, you know, people who maybe have, in inverted commas, a nominal Christian faith, which is kind of one that parents may have kind of, you know, I went along to church with them sort of thing, but they discover it for themselves. And what can change is an attitude towards prayer, towards, you know, actually, you know, reading the Bible, towards engaging with that kind of thing. Has that changed at all?
I have more of an understanding of the Bible, but yeah, I don't tend to read it as much as perhaps I should. But I have a copy of a Bible, you know, on my shelf in my room. I can sort of look at if I feel I want to look at it, it's there if I need it.
And prayer, do you feel like, you know, you're able to pray more now, or has that changed much for you?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, you know, I pray, you know, when, you know, something's going, I need, you know, something like, you know, like applying for a job or whatever, you know, I'll pray about that.
Well, obviously you're still on a journey. We're all on a journey, in a way, with the Christian life. So all power to you as you continue your journey.
Thank you very much.
You know, I know that you've got interest in radio as well.
I have.
Just tell us a bit about that. What do you do?
I do hospital radio in Surrey at St Peter's Hospital, Chertsey. I've been doing that for about 10 years. So I was a volunteer, and involves going around wards, speaking to patients in hospitals that we cover. Three local hospitals. Go around the hospital, speak to patients, get their requests, and you know, bits and pieces like that.
Great.
And presenting two programmes a week.
Great. Well, if you're a listener and you are in that area, or you indeed a resident at that one of the hospitals, which
on the internet as well.
On the internet as well. Give us the internet address.
It's www.radioway.co.uk, and that's way with W-E-Y.
radioway.co.uk. Thank you very much, John. Well, we haven't had too much response to the programmes of the last few weeks. Obviously, it's one where people have been able to listen and take notes, and not too much, as it were, disagreement, obviously, with those who are Christians coming on to give us those in-depth interviews. But we have had a lot of response to a different programme, which is available on the Unbelievable webpage. You can't get it via the podcast, this one. So if you want to listen to it, you've got to visit the Premier Unbelievable webpage. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And it's a documentary I recorded, A Day in the Life of J. Smith and the Hyde Park Christian Fellowship, and their controversial evangelism of the Muslims that congregate there. It's called Up the Ladder in Hyde Park, and I'm just going to play a snippet of the programme, just the first minute or so, just to whet your appetite if you haven't had a chance to listen to that programme yet. There is a place where Christians and Muslims are at war.
How many people would rather live in a Muslim state or in Britain today? Because Muslims are going to act nice today. It's what they're going to do once they start applying that book.
The rhetoric is fierce, the atmosphere charged.
You can keep the Christianity, you can keep the backward religion, you can keep the Trinity, you can keep the three gods. We only need one God. Allahu Akbar.
Why you don't let Christians even enter to Mecca? Why don't you let Christians to make their churches and worship God in their way in the Muslim country?
It's a place where ideology, doctrine and culture clash, and controversy is never far away.
This kind of work is unique. There's no other place on earth that we can do what we're going to do this afternoon. We can't push the buttons like this. We're going to be saying things that are very controversial. It's an environment where you do confront. Highly confrontational.
But this isn't some conflict-ridden religious hotspot of the world. This is Sunday afternoon at Speaker's Corner in central London. It's 3 p.m. and I've arrived at Hyde Park. I've heard about certain debates that take place here, and I've come to find out more. I'm a guest of Jay Smith and his team, the Hyde Park Christian Fellowship. Jay is an American missionary to Muslims and has made his mission field London for the past 15 years. Much of his work is focused... Well, there you are, the start of the programme. It's online, as I say, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I'm continuing to get a lot of response to the programme. And not just Christians, Muslims as well. In fact, had a response from Adnan, one of the Muslims featured in the documentary. Adnan said, I did listen to the documentary, found it to be very insightful. I never imagined myself sounding like a Christian hater. And I think that's what I sounded like. Perhaps it was to do with shouting at the top of my voice, not realising what that could sound like to a radio listener. The documentary has taught me to be more gentle and calmer in order to seem more objective. But the dilemma is, how does one do that in the park? And I can totally see the dilemma there for you, Adnan, because it's a very sort of, you know, loud atmosphere, and it's very hard to imagine you not shouting at the top of your voice to get your points across. But, yeah, thanks to Andy, who said, listen to the Hyde Park programme. Sounds great. Good job. Thank you, Andy. And also Nazam, another Muslim who was one of the people I spoke to at the park. Nazam says, I had a chance to listen to the broadcast, and overall I thought it was a well-balanced and entertaining documentary. But I'm not sure how many people would like to go and visit Speaker's Corner after having listened to the documentary with its scary music being played in the background. If there is room for improvement, then I'd like to hear more Muslim female voices being interviewed, who also come out to talk to Christians and non-Christians alike in the park. It was fun spotting whose voices you interviewed during the documentary. Thanks also to P. Bramson, I think it's Paul Bramson, sent me his book, One God, One Message. You also have a ministry to Muslims, Paul, and you've sent me your book. Say thanks for the recent programme on Jay Smith and the Hyde Park Fellowship. I worked alongside Jay for 4 years. He's a great brother. Thought you might appreciate a copy of my latest offering for reaching Muslims. Like your programme, Unbelievable, it answers the hard questions graciously. Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you for getting in contact, and thank you for your sentiments regarding the programme. We do try to answer the hard questions graciously here on Unbelievable, and we're going to be answering one of the hardest ones of all on the programme today, as Alvin Plantinger is with us. He is a noted philosopher at Notre Dame University in the States. He really is a leader in the field when it comes to his particular areas of research in philosophy. So it's worth sitting back and taking some notes as we talk to a seasoned veteran of Christian thinking. That's to come here on the programme. And do get in touch. We'd like to hear back from you in regard to anything you hear. So if a thought pops into your head, do get on the email and drop me a line. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you'd like to phone, it's 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Well, before we hear from Alvin, it's time to catch up with John Pusselton. He's asking, or at least answering, another frequently asked question.
Frequently asked questions with John Twistleton.
To repeat the question, weren't the divinity of Christ and the Trinity made up by Constantine? Christianity was different before and after Constantine, but was doctrine different as well? Before the 4th century Roman Emperor Constantine, Christians were persecuted. After Constantine, the persecution lifted. His Edict of Milan in 313 AD recognized all religions equally. It led to the establishment of Christianity across the world, even to this day. It also led to the first church council since New Testament days. Christian teaching could be spelled out worldwide for the first time. Being illegal, it had been impossible for the Christian church to hold a conference on doctrine. As soon as freedom came, a conference followed. In 325 AD, the Council of Nicaea proclaimed the divinity of Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity in the now familiar words of the Nicene Creed. But was the Nicene Creed a fix? Did Constantine call the tune, or the Holy Spirit? The Nicene Creed voiced the status quo. It defined what was already the case. Just as, for example, the BBC Radio 1 Top 10 doesn't define what's selling, but reflects, sorry. Just as the BBC Radio 1 Top 10 doesn't define what's selling well, but reflects what's selling well, so the Council of Nicaea proclaimed what was the case, rather than promoting a new line. How can I say this? From a knowledge of church history that has been uncontroversial until fiction writers like Dan Brown got to promote their novelties. That an initially unbaptized man, Constantine, should convene a church council is, of course, remarkable. The emperor simply used his own authority to provide a forum for Christians to unite after their persecution. This they did as their bishops, led by Athanasius, came to a common mind in rejecting out of hand the teachings of Arius. Now, Arius had taught Christ was a man who became God. He'd implied that if Jesus could become God through hard effort, we could become God too. It's an appealing doctrine. It lives on today in a lot of religions. God is someone you can get to if you really work at it. The bishops at Nicaea knew their scripture. They knew that it was, as Paul says, God who was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, and that while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. That God proves his love for us in that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. The whole point of Christianity is the revelation of God in a human being, bringing salvation to believers by pure, unbounded grace. God sent his only Son into the world, writes St. John, so that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the atoning sacrifice for our sins. What Arius taught remains an ongoing challenge to mainstream Christianity. The Arian heresy denies God was in Christ, and that salvation is a gift from God. In making Christ less than he is, it undermines the whole Christian revelation. It also makes Christianity a religion where you have to try hard rather than trust hard. Weren't the divinity of Christ and the Trinity made up by Constantine? To come back to the question, the Emperor Constantine indeed helped Christians to state their truth aloud, and that truth was and is the truth about God in the light of Jesus. The Trinity is taught in the New Testament, though the word isn't there. Matthew's Gospel ends with Christ's call to baptize in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. The operation of the Father, Son and Spirit is there in the account of Jesus' baptism. It's taught in John chapter 14 and implied throughout Paul's writings, as when he greets his readers with the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit. The Trinity is mentioned centuries before Constantine by 2nd and 3rd century writers like Polycarp, Justin Martyr and Tertullian. When God became flesh, it took centuries to find words that could properly talk of God. Constantine happened to be the world ruler when this first happened. The claim that the emperor, or Christianity itself, established Christ's divinity in the 4th century flies in the face of evidence from the New Testament and 3 centuries of Christian writing. All of these thrill with the truth of the living Christ. Christianity hasn't invented the lordship of Christ. It's rather a movement carried forward by it.
If you have any difficult questions about the Christian faith, or have your own answer for the frequently asked question we looked at today, please visit www.premier.org.uk/FAQ to contribute to the program.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you've been listening to the programme of late, you'll know that we've dispensed with our usual format of a Christian and a non-Christian in the studio in order to bring you a special edition of the programme, as we've been looking at American masters of Christian thinking. And my guest today is Alvin Plantinga. Now, Alvin has been described as the most important philosopher of religion now writing. He's got a glittering career in philosophy and has delivered lectures all over the world. He's currently the John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, and he is a Christian. Alvin, thank you very much for joining me on the program today.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you with me. As I've explained, this program is a little different to the usual sort of program we have. I'd love you to take us back to how things started out for you, because you do come from a Christian background originally, don't you?
I do, uh-huh.
So what sort of an environment was it that you grew up in?
I grew up in a Christian family. My parents were both Christians, as were my grandparents. They were all roughly Reformed Christians. They came from the Netherlands originally, my grandparents did. So the sort of Christianity that they practiced was, roughly speaking, Dutch Calvinism, which is sort of like Presbyterianism, only it's Dutch rather than Scottish or British.
So you grew up in that sort of religious atmosphere. As a sort of Dutch Calvinist, if you like, what did that mean for you as far as when you were growing up? Was that different to the Christianity elsewhere in the States where you were based?
Not really. I mean, as I was growing up, when I was a young fellow, you know, a lad, 8, 9, 10, what it meant basically was very long sermons, very long church services, 2 every Sunday. And in the summertime, I would spend a lot of time counting the tiles and the ceilings and wishing I were outside. Later on, at a certain point in my life, say, I don't know, 14, 15, it all seemed to come alive. I mean, before that, I accepted it, Christianity, because my parents taught it to me, and everybody I knew thought along these lines. But at that age, as often happens with people, suddenly it became alive and viable and seemed right and salient. And that's when I became, you might say, a more serious Christian.
And was it always for you... It was very much on an intellectual level, or was there something extra to that happened when you did have that sort of experience?
No, it wasn't really intellectual at all. It had a great deal of existential force, a feeling of God's presence and love, and of my obligations to God and my intention to be a serious Christian and live before Him as His children should. So it was by no means just intellectual matter like a philosophical theory or something of that sort.
And how early on did you sort of
have leanings towards the academic side of you know, the road, if you like?
Well, I grew up in North and South Dakota, and their education opportunities in those days, we're talking a long time ago, we're talking the 40s, 1940s, were a little thin in the ground. My father was a professor in a small college in Huron, South Dakota. In this college, I think there were the college or university, as it perhaps to be called in England, there were only 12 faculty members, and he was obliged to teach Latin and Greek and religion and psychology and philosophy and who knows what else. I think sociology, perhaps other things as well. Anyway, I grew up in that kind of atmosphere. Now, let's see, what was the question you were asking me exactly?
Well, I was wondering, what drew you into an academic sort of life?
Well, my father thought that opportunities along these lines were a little thin there, so he began teaching me Latin when I was young, and I started reading Plato's dialogues when I was maybe 12 or 13, and I guess I more or less intended to be a philosopher from then on.
What was it? Did it just engage you in a way that no other pursuit did?
It just seemed interesting, you know, fascinating, sometimes a sort of overwhelming fascination. And it just struck me as what I wanted to spend my time doing. Well, I shouldn't make it sound as if all I thought about was philosophy when I was in junior high and high school. Not at all. I was very much interested in athletics, very much interested in girls, very much interested in, you know, doing the sort of things people at that age do. But I did also have this really sort of burgeoning interest in philosophy.
Mm. And the kind of environment you were in, was it a predominantly sort of Christian environment, would you say?
It certainly was as far as my home life was concerned, and as far as I went to church with my family. In school, questions of Christianity versus non-Christianity didn't really seem to show up at all. You know, it wasn't sort of, it wasn't anything that was really on the radar.
I mean, I'm guessing that would change later when you entered more, you know, academic circles where obviously atheism was, you know, possibly the major preference for many people.
It did change for me. In particular, I went to Harvard for a year, Harvard University. My father made me leave high school at the end of my junior year. He thought I wasn't learning anything. So the next year I went to college, first to Jamestown College. Again, this would be what in the UK you'd think of as university. Jamestown College in Jamestown, North Dakota for one semester, and Calvin College the second semester, where my father had moved to become a professor of psychology there. Well, then that was really my last year of high school, you might say. So the first year of university, I went to Harvard University, and there for the first time I ran into people who were extremely intelligent, extremely accomplished intellectually, and who didn't share my beliefs at all, who were agnostics or atheists or naturalists or whatever. And I got involved in all kinds of discussion and argument. At that point in my life, these questions about whether Christian belief is true, whether it's rational or reasonable, these questions then assumed a they took over a large proportion of what I thought about.
Well, we're going to be finding out all about it as we continue in the program today. But, Alvin, you really have spent most of your life defending, if you like, the rationalism of Christian belief. We're just going to pick your brains across the next hour or so as we find out more about your life, but also get your views on some of the major themes that have been your interest in philosophy, particularly the problem of evil, which so many people, whether they like it or not, will come across just from an experiential point of view. How can a good loving God allow evil in the world? And it's something you've devoted a lot of time, I know, to trying to look into philosophically. That's all to come here on the programme, so do stay with us. My guest on the programme today, my only guest on the programme today, is Alvin Plantinga, part of my special series at the moment on Unbelievable, with American Masters of Christian Thinking. Alvin Plantinga has been described as the most important philosopher of religion now writing, which gives you a clue as to why I wanted to have him on the programme. And we're going to be continuing to chat with him during the rest of the programme through till 4 o'clock this afternoon.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Continuing our series of programmes here on Unbelievable, away from our normal format of having two guests in the studio, we're just concentrating on some individuals at the moment, particularly individuals in the US who have had a big impact on Christian thinking in the modern day. Alvin Plantinga has been a very influential voice in philosophy. Writing as a Christian philosopher, he's published many papers, delivered many lectures around the world, and is currently the John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. And I'd like to just continue, if you'll allow me, Alvin, to chart some of your progress, because in many ways, I think many people, perhaps if they're Christians and they've thought about doing something like philosophy, they might be nervous, just thinking, well, is that going to in any way damage my faith? Because I think many people assume that the philosophical world is populated by atheists who will do the very best they can to destroy any belief in God. Well, I mean, was that your experience at all? And did you have any major challenges to your faith as you started to develop your career in philosophy?
I went to Harvard. I was at the time of something like 17 years old or so. I don't really think so. I didn't hear, I did take a couple of philosophy courses, but I didn't hear a whole lot of people arguing against Christian belief in these courses. I heard a great deal more of it outside among my student companions. And then, as now, I think, perhaps the three main objections brought against Christian belief were, first, as you mentioned, the problem of evil. How can it be that if there is this all-powerful, all-knowing, perfectly good God, how could it be that there are so many horrifying things that go on in our world? And secondly, the thought was, there just aren't any good arguments for Christianity. Why should I believe that? I mean, give me some arguments.
Mm.
And then the third one would be something like, hasn't science really dispensed with the whole necessity or reason for believing in Christian, accepting Christian belief, or even just believing in God? Don't we now know so much more than people knew in the old times that these beliefs are no longer sensible?
So these were the kinds of questions and arguments you were coming against. Did you have to grapple with this? Was this, did you sort of relish this as a kind of a challenge to your intellect? Did you ever have any ultimate doubts about your Christian belief?
I can't say I had any ultimate doubts, but at first I was somewhat shaken. I mean, here were these people, many of them far more accomplished intellectually than I, who knew a great deal more, seemed to have thought about these things more deeply, and their views were so completely different from mine. Could it really be that mine were right and theirs wrong? But I had a certain kind of experience one time when I was a student there at Harvard, walking back from dinner on a November evening. It was dark outside and cold and rainy. And all of a sudden I felt sort of surrounded by God's presence. It was as if the heavens sort of, I can't go into this in too much detail, sort of opened, and my whole attitude was sort of transformed. I felt, yeah, these things that I had sort of believed all the time are in fact true. And after that, I continued to engage in argument and discussion, of course, all the time along these lines. But I didn't really, they were a little bit more academic. They weren't really existential. It wasn't that I myself was trying to find out whether there was such a person as God. I was sure that there was, and what I wanted to do was defend this kind of belief.
Would it be fair to say that many people do come to philosophy with their beliefs already there, and they will argue philosophically in favour of whichever way they do believe?
Well, I think that's basically correct, and I think it's basically how it should go. I mean, what philosophy is essentially is a matter of thinking really deeply and hard about important matters. And of course, you come with a whole set of beliefs. If you're a Christian, you come with beliefs about God and the work of Christ and the like of that. If you're an atheist, you come with quite a different set of beliefs. It isn't that philosophy itself, you know, provides some answer to these questions. At least I don't think it does. I don't think philosophy can show you one way or the other that there is such a person as God. I think there are some pretty good arguments for God's existence, philosophical arguments, but I don't think they are sufficiently strong to support the kind of belief most Christians actually have.
Hmm. And would you say that the object of philosophy, is it from your point of view at least, to persuade people of the existence of God, or is that ultimately something that you'll never actually convince someone of philosophically? It's something they have to experience, in the same way that what you said you experienced was something very subjective. It wasn't a philosophical experience. It was something where you felt you had touched the divine in some way.
Well, I think people occasionally do get converted, we might say, or come to believe in God by way of philosophy. I think C.S. Lewis said that philosophical argument played a considerable role in his coming to Christian belief. Then, of course, there's Anthony Flew more recently, who also, by virtue of argument, came to something like theism, or at least deism. But for the most part, I don't think that's how it goes with people. It isn't that you come to believe in God by virtue of arguments. And I don't see why it has to be. I mean, you might consider other beliefs we all have, for example, that there are other people. There are some philosophical arguments for there being other people, but nobody believes that there are other people on the basis of those arguments. These arguments are relatively weak, and maybe they make it a little more likely than not that there are other people. But we all take this belief with, I mean, we just hold it, you might say, instinctively. We are programmed to believe that sort of thing. And it's more like that, seems to me, also with belief in God. It's not that the right way to come to belief in God is to be persuaded by philosophical arguments.
Hmm. Well, what happened then for you during this time? How did you start to tackle some of those key questions? I mean, and let's take the key one that you mentioned there, the problem of evil, because that's been a major part of your work over the years. Was it at this point when you were at Harvard that you began what's is termed the free will defense?
No, that started a little later, after I actually got to graduate school and left graduate school in my first job as a young professor, I guess you'd say lecturer there, a young lecturer, professor of philosophy at Wayne State University in the late 1950s. That's when I started thinking about the free will defense. The problem of evil is not, it seems to me, just a merely academic problem. Lots and lots of Christians have problems along these lines, I think. When tragedy strikes one or one's loved ones and the like, one can really start wondering, well, why does God permit this? If he loves me, if he's a God of love, why does he permit my wife to fall ill, or one of my children to die, or why does he permit these terrible things, terrible natural disasters? How does that fit together? How can that be?
Absolutely, and this has been a question that has been come up time and time again on this program. I mean, this program has been going over 2.5 years now, and it's a question that comes round periodically when we have atheists here in the studio. I remember one atheist who was actually a former church minister, but now sort of a professional atheist, and he just put it very simply. He said, as far as I'm concerned, anyone who simply walks into a children's hospital for terminally ill children has their answer as to whether there is a God. When they walk by those beds and see a child dying of cancer, and all it would take would be one act from God to take away the illness, to make that child whole again, and yet the child dies. That in itself was enough for that person to be completely convinced that there was no God. So it's an extremely emotive issue, isn't it? And as I said, one that people won't just come to philosophically, but will come to because of incidences in their life, which will force them to face the question. Now for you, you've obviously taken a philosophical approach to the question. I'd love to go into that, and we will do, how you tackle that philosophically. But ultimately, do philosophical reasoning help people who are actually in the midst of that kind of turmoil?
I don't know that philosophical reasoning does help a lot. I think this is it's more, as you say, a matter of life experience, more a sort of existential matter. But still, one of the main reasons people give for rejecting belief in God just is the problem of evil. And it's important to respond to those reasons. It's important that there be people who actually think about these arguments and look to see whether they're good arguments. I myself don't think they are good arguments.
Okay, well, take us through then. When you started developing one of the aspects of your philosophical work, which you're best known for, this free will defense, and I'm going to have to ask you, obviously, to try and keep this in as layperson's terms as possible for the sake of myself as much as any listener, but what was that, and what was this thought that sort of suddenly revolutionized your thinking about this problem of evil?
Well, The way in which people approach the problem of evil, that is, the way in which people offered arguments against the existence of God when I started off in philosophy, was to claim that there is a contradiction here, that it's just logically impossible that there should be such a person as God, who is wholly good, all-knowing, and all-powerful, and at the same time that there be evil. Any evil, even a little teensy bit of evil. The thought was, this is just a contradiction. And I argued by way of the free will defense that it's not a contradiction. It's perfectly possible that God, by virtue of freedom he confers on his creatures, that he couldn't get a world in which there are people who do the right thing, at least much of the time, and also nobody who ever does anything that's wrong. It could perfectly well be that this wasn't anything God could accomplish. It just wasn't a possibility. I didn't mean to go on and say that, as a matter of fact, that's the right answer to why there is evil. All I was doing was simply arguing that this claim of contradiction is false. It's perfectly possible both that there be such a God, omnipotent, omniscient, holy good, and that there be evil. So that was the first stage. The second stage, after that, philosophers tended, for the most part, not to claim that there was contradiction here anymore. Instead, they said, it's just exceedingly unlikely that there should be such a person as God, omniscient, omnipotent, perfectly good, given all the evil in the world. And that's, of course, a very different sort of claim.
So, take us through that then, because in the first place, those who would say there's a contradiction here, if I can sort of outline a very basic way of putting it, it would be that, well, if God is all-loving and all-powerful, and we can see things that are obviously evil in the world around us, God has the power to change it, and he has the will to change it because he loves us. So why doesn't he change it? Why does that evil continue? So why doesn't the child with, well, why does the child contract cancer in the first place? So when you're saying it's a matter of free will, what are you saying by that? How are you claiming that this that it's not contradictory, in a sense that there should be an all-loving, all-powerful God and evil in the world? Because on the face of it does look contradictory. If God is all-loving and all-powerful, then surely by definition that means he shouldn't be allowing the evil to happen.
Well, unless there is something he wants to achieve such that he can't have that, can't achieve that without permitting evil. So perhaps, here's a possibility. Again, I don't say this is the real reason. I'll say in a minute what I think something closer to what the real reason is. But suppose he wants to have free creatures who freely do, at least sometimes, freely do what's right. Free creatures who do moral good. But when he creates free creatures, he can't cause them to do what's good. He can't just make it the case that they do what's good, freely good, because if he does that, they don't do so freely. Then they aren't free. And it might turn out that things could be like this, that he creates free creatures and some of them do what's wrong. But he can't have free creatures to sometimes do what's right without having some who also sometimes do what's wrong. So that would be one way in which there was something he wants to achieve, such that he can't achieve that without permitting evil.
I mean, I can see how that would work in the context of to have free will, to be able to have the option to do good or indeed to do bad. We have to have the option to do bad, and so therefore people will choose to do evil. But what do you do about the case of where there doesn't seem to be any person who's, you know, intentionally done anything, but there is something bad going on? So the child who does contract cancer, no one's to blame for that. Someone's by their free will they somehow gave this child cancer, but nonetheless she has it. Isn't God obliged in that instance to not allow that evil?
Well, maybe we can think about that in a second, but I mean, my original point was just there isn't any contradiction, as philosophers originally claimed that there is, between the propositions that there is evil and God is all good, all powerful, and so on. So that's after philosophers became more or less convinced of that, they moved on to this other thing.
Mm.
But let me make a suggestion. You know, I think in the first place, Christians have to concede that they don't really know why God permits evil. We Christians think God is perfectly good. We think he could, in many cases, prevent evils that actually do occur. We don't know why he doesn't. I mean, I think when we have to think about these things along the lines that Job did, right? Here was Job. He was, as he thought, a good man. In fact, the story says he was a good man. And then he was subjected to all of these terrible sufferings and evils. And what he did was, at first he was inclined for a long time to question God, to ask God, why do you do this? You know, I wish I could go to court with you. I would argue my case. You are clearly not treating me properly. He was very angry with God.
Mm.
At the very end, he comes to realize that he doesn't really know where this evil comes from. Actually, according to the story, it originates in a transaction between God and Satan. Satan isn't even anything Job knows about in the story. He doesn't, but he comes to see God's beauty and glory and sort of great wonderfulness. And then while he still doesn't know why God permits all this evil to happen to him or causes all this evil to happen to him, he no longer feels rebellious. He thinks, well, this is God. He's got some reason for this. I don't know what the reason is. I wish I did, but he's got some reason.
Mm.
And it seems to me that's more or less the attitude Christians have to take. Here's one sort of way of thinking about it.
Mm.
In the Catholic liturgy for Easter vigil, for Saturday vigil before Easter, there is the phrase, O felix culpa, O happy sin, as if the sin somehow is useful, worthwhile. Well, and why is it worthwhile? Because it led to this possibility of salvation. So, you mind if I go on for a minute here?
Yeah, of course, go ahead.
So imagine God, you might say, before creation. I mean, that's just a picture, of course, but imagine God before creation. He wants to create a really good world. There are all these possibilities, all these possible worlds that are, you might say, lie before him, and he can choose. He has to choose which one he wants to actually bring into actuality. Well, if you ask yourself, what would make one world a better world than another? You know, what would be a good making property or characteristic for a possible world? Think about this. According to the Christian story, God is the first being of the universe, the creator of the universe. We all owe him obedience and so on. We human beings turned our back on God, according to the Christian story. We turned our back on God and fell into sin. And he, though he was the first being King of the universe, and though we had turned our back on him, proposed this enormously, enormously exciting story of incarnation and redemption, incarnation and atonement. He himself was willing to undergo enormous suffering so that we human beings who had turned our back on him could once more regain his favor, once more be in the proper relationship with him. Now, what could make one, I mean, what could be a more of a great-making property or a good-making property of a possible world than that it contain, that something like that sort of story or history be part of it? It seems to me it's hard to think of any. I mean, what could make one world greater than another, more greater than another along than something along those very lines, something along the lines of incarnation and atonement? So maybe most of the best possible worlds, the really good possible worlds, contain incarnation and atonement, or at any rate atonement, this God's being willing to undergo great suffering, sacrifice, in order to enable us to achieve a better relationship with him. If the best worlds all contain that sort of thing, contain atonement, well, then the best worlds also all contain sin. If you have atonement, you also have sin. You have to have something that has to be atoned for. So one possibility here, then, one possibility that's worth at least thinking about, I mean, who knows whether it's the real answer or not, is that all the best worlds contain atonement, and atonement requires sin, and requires a lot of it, not just a minor peccadillo on the part of an otherwise admirably disposed angel.
Mm. It's a very interesting way of looking at it. And in a sense, you're saying that evil has to exist in order for a better outcome to occur. So if evil wasn't there, we would actually have a less good world than because it is here. Because it's there, it's allowed God to play out this story of redemption, which makes our world a much better, more beautiful place to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, but an atheist surely would say to that, well, I think this atonement incarnation business is all very mystifying and strange and not at all something that I consider to be necessary for a beautiful world. I'd rather my niece hadn't died the other day. That would be far more interesting to me. And, you know, so, I mean, doesn't it just depend on what you conceive of as being a better world than another?
I guess basically, from a Christian perspective, it depends on what God conceives of as a really good world. But I mean, it seems to me to make perfectly good sense to suppose that the best worlds would contain this wonderful story of redemption. I mean, maybe not everybody wants to be part of that. But that's not really the question. I mean, the question is whether God could have a good reason for permitting evil, and I suggest this is a good reason for permitting evil. It does, of course, depend on a value judgment, but then so does the whole problem of evil in the first place.
I remember speaking to one person who said that, well, maybe, you know, if we're talking about best possible worlds, isn't it logically possible for God to have created a world where everybody did choose the right thing, even with free will? There's a logically possible world where everyone will choose to do the right thing. So, I mean, does that at all go against this idea, or is it just the fact that, as far as you're concerned, having Christian salvation, having the redemption story, is better even than that kind of a world?
Well, two things. I mean, that's the first thing to say is that that's back again to the free will defense. The free will defense argues that it's possible that even though there are possible worlds in which there are people who do what's right and nobody ever does what's wrong, even though that's logically possible, it still might be that God couldn't actually bring one of those possible worlds into actuality. It might be that it wasn't within his power to actualize a world in which there is moral good but no moral evil.
Why would that be? Because wouldn't one say, well, then God isn't omnipotent? Because if it's a logical possibility, then surely God has the power to do it.
No, I would say not. I mean, it's logically possible that I never do what's wrong, and that I, on a given occasion, let's say, I freely refrain from doing what's wrong. That's a logically possible situation. It's not one God can cause to be actual, because if he causes me never to do what's wrong or not to do what's wrong on that occasion, then on that occasion I don't freely refrain from doing what's wrong. So there are plenty of possible states of affairs God can't cause to be actual, even though he's omnipotent. He can't cause me to freely do something, even though, of course, it's perfectly possible that I freely do that thing.
This is a very interesting way of approaching it, and I think that for most people, they kind of don't think about it in terms of this, you know, a possible world and that sort of thing. They just see, well, this is the world that there is.
Right.
This is the world that God created, and here am I, and I'm suffering in some way, and that doesn't, you know, why doesn't God help me? God has the power to help me. God doesn't help me. But ultimately, from a purely philosophical point of view, at least, you would say you have to look beyond that at what God is doing in the larger picture, which may be better than your suffering, you know, than how you think of your suffering as being unhelpful right now.
Yeah, well, let's think about that just a bit further. I mean, I said there were two things there. The other thing was the very thing you mentioned, a world... A world in which this enormous, this powerful and amazing story of redemption, incarnation, atonement, redemption, takes place, I think is better than a world in which there are a lot of free creatures who always do only what's right. What's remarkable about incarnation and redemption is just the enormous love displayed by God. Making it possible for people who have turned their back on him to come close to him again, and doing so by virtue of himself undergoing enormous suffering. It seems to me it's an absolutely marvelous story, a marvelous history, a marvelous state of affairs, and a world characterized by that sort of behavior on the part of the first being of the universe seems to me is, everything else being equal, better than a world in which there are a lot of finite creatures like us who always do the right thing. So worlds like that, I would say, are among the best possible worlds.
We're going to continue discussing in just a moment's time. I'm with Alvin Plantinga. Alvin has been described as the most important philosopher of religion now writing, and he's the John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, and he's featuring today in our current series here on Unbelievable of American Masters of Christian Thinking. We're going to be back with him in just a moment as we continue talking about the philosophical aspects of Christian belief and how Alvin has been defending them over the years that he's been writing, speaking, and teaching in philosophy. We'll be back with our guest Alvin Plantinga in just a moment here on Unbelievable, and he is the third in line of our American Masters of Apologetics and Christian Thinking. Now, you will hear our fourth Master of American Apologetics slightly out of turn, because he's actually coming on in 2 weeks' time. That is Norman Geisler, who's well known for his defense of the Bible and the literal interpretation of the Bible, you know, inerrancy, that it is, as it were, inerrant in the original text. He's coming on, as I say, the week after next. Next week, you can hear a special discussion on faith schools. That's between Andrew Copson, who's from the British Humanist Association. That's obviously primarily atheistic in his outlook. And that'll be with Jan Ainsworth, who's the Church of England's officer for education. And, of course, there are many Church of England schools around the country. She's going to be defending the existence of those schools, why she believes it's a good idea to put faith in the educational environment, and we're going to be hearing from Andrew why, as an atheist, he believes there's no place for that kind of faith in the schooling of young children. That's at the same time, between 2:30 and 4 o'clock next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Special edition of the program today. In the last few weeks, we've been looking at American Masters of Christian Thinking. Today, Alvin Plantinga is my guest on the program, joining us live from the University of Notre Dame, where he is a professor of philosophy. And Alvin has had a long career in philosophy. We've been hearing about it in the earlier part of the program, particularly looking at his defense of the free will, well, his free will defense, which has really touched the philosophical world with a way of thinking about the problem of evil. And we've just really skirted around it, but given a good idea of how you've defended that over the years, Alvin. Do people sort of regard you as something of a strange item, being obviously an academic and of great high standing in the philosophical world, but also being a Christian? Is that fairly unusual these days, would you say?
Well, it partly depends on where you are. It's not terribly unusual in the United States. In the United States now, there are lots and lots of talented academic philosophers who are also Christians. In fact, a while back, there was a piece in a skeptical journal edited by a man named Quentin Smith, the name of the journalist Philo, in which he lamented the fact that philosophy had become unsecularized. All the other disciplines became properly secularized in the 1950s and or had been secularized by then. But in the United States, philosophy took a different turn. And in fact, there are now, as he laments and as I rejoice in, very many Christian philosophers, especially very many young Christian philosophers. So at the moment, it's not so unusual here. It is unusual in, much more unusual in Great Britain and other parts of Europe. But I think here it's really, you might think in a way, it's really Europe that's out of step with the rest of the world. It's not so much the United States is out of step with Europe, but it's Europe that's out of step with the rest of the world. As a matter of fact, probably some, I don't know, 8 or 9 out of 10 people in the world do, in fact, believe in God.
You're
or something very like God, anyway.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, your Christian beliefs obviously owe much to your upbringing. But if you like, once you have obviously been challenged by all manner of other beliefs, what persuades you that Christianity is the answer? You may have a belief in God, but why are you a Christian rather than a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu or some other person who believes in God?
Well, I mean, it's partly just why do people accept Christian belief? I think the answer is, according to the theological answer, according to the Bible and according to many others, say John Calvin and Aquinas, is that there is the internal, something like what Calvin called the internal testimony or witness of the Holy Spirit. God himself shows you that this is in fact right. How does that show up, say, subjectively or from the inside, you might say? It shows up just by this, by the Christian story seeming correct, seeming right, seeming not just correct and right, but also inspiring, and such as to be extremely attractive, to attract love.
Mm.
I think that's the way it seems from the inside. If you ask, okay, well, can I give you some good arguments as to why Christianity is better than, say, Islam or Judaism? I think that would be pretty difficult, but I do think there's something to be said there. The fact that Christianity's got a real resource with respect to the problem of evil that other theistic religions don't have, and that just is the fact that God himself was willing to suffer with us in order to accomplish, enable us to achieve salvation. There isn't anything like that in Judaism and Islam, but in Christianity, we may not know why God permits these evils, but we do know this. He's willing also to undergo suffering in order to achieve a state of affairs that is that he considers worthwhile and good.
I'd like to refer now to Richard Dawkins, Alvin. Richard Dawkins, of course, for many years really kept to his own field of biological research, etc. But obviously, with the God delusion, we've seen him elaborate on all kinds of different things, not least philosophical arguments for God. And I know you, among many other philosophers, have come back lambasting, really, his attempts to do philosophy. I think in a review I read by you, you said, you know, this would be graded very poorly if it was a sophomore, i.e. a first-year attempt in university to kind of grapple with some of these philosophical ideas. Nonetheless, it's been a best-selling book, and I know plenty of intelligent people who have picked it up, put it down, and said, yes, I'm convinced. What needs to be done in this case, then? What do you think can be done to help people engage on a, if you like, more scholarly level with the arguments to do with the existence of God?
Well, I don't think the existence, I don't think it's all that important for a Christian belief that there be good arguments for the existence of God. I think there are some pretty good ones, but I don't think Christian belief or Christian faith or just belief in God, for that matter, rest on those arguments. It is important to see, though, how ridiculously weak Dawkins' arguments against the existence of God really are. I mean, he does raise this question, you know, well, who created God then? I think you mentioned earlier that's a kind of schoolboy question.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is the kind of thing that you might find from anyone, really, as a very basic question, you know, about God. Well, you know, there must have been something behind God. And I suppose he puts it a little bit more technically than that. He has this idea that if you're going to try and suggest that there is a creator of the universe, that the universe has a reason, then that reason would have to be just as complicated as the universe itself, I think, is the way it runs.
Yeah, that's a slightly different tack. Mm-hmm. But with respect to the first tack, who created God, the whole idea of God is of a being who is not created, who has always existed, who in fact exists necessarily. That's the way Christians have thought about God from the beginning. So the question, well, where did he come from then? How did he get there? That's not a sensible question. You might try to argue, well, everything has to be such that there has to be a reason for its existence, and you have to be able to say where it comes from. But naturalists don't think that either. They don't think the natural world is like that, that our universe itself, or the existence of matter is such that there is a reason for that. Now, on this other thing about complication and complexity, he says God would have to be extremely complex, and anything that's extremely complex is very improbable. But again, I don't see, I mean, what makes him think that God would have to be extremely complex? Again, it's part of Christian belief that God is simple, and that many of the distinctions that hold for the rest of things don't hold for him. For example, in him, there isn't both... it's not the case that there is a component matter, let's say. He's not composed of matter. He doesn't have that kind of complexity. He doesn't have any parts. Dawkins elsewhere says complexity is a matter of having parts that are put together in a certain way. But the Christian idea is that God doesn't have any parts, so he's not going to be complex.
Hmm.
So, I mean, Dawkins just, it seems to me he's basically, when he talks theology, he basically talks through his hat. And it's also that he doesn't really take a look at what philosophers and theologians say. He just kind of goes off in his own direction, acting as if, or at least betraying no acquaintance with what people that think about these things say at all.
But I've had plenty of people, though, who've come on this show and suggested, in common, I think, with Richard Dawkins, more or less, that, well, God was a perfectly good explanation for things when people didn't understand as much, you know, when people didn't realise why the rain fell, they assumed that it was God sending the rain, and if they sent up their prayers or made a sacrifice, that it would be more likely that the rain would come. And so, you know, God has always been effectively part of a superstitious kind of lifestyle, and now that we've got proper scientific explanations for things, we've really lost the need for this belief in God. I mean, I think Richard Dawkins would very much see belief in God these days as a hangover from a sort of a medieval past.
He probably would. But that's to assume that the reason people believe in God is that they propose God as a kind of scientific hypothesis or explanation. I mean, is that how, in fact, people actually do believe in God? Do they say to themselves, Well, how can it be that there are all these creatures of various kinds, that there's this world and so on? There must be such a person as God. And furthermore, he must be a Trinity and so on. I would say, of course not. It's part of our very nature, I think, to believe that there is such a person as God or something like God. Calvin spoke here of a sensus divinitatis. And in contemporary studies, in scientific study of religion, the most common view is that this is part of our nature. We are wired to believe in something like God. It's not that we come up with a need for an explanation and then invent this hypothesis. It's rather this idea, like that the idea that there are other persons, that there's been a past, that there is an external world. It's part of how we naturally think. So, I mean, the fact that we have these scientific explanations for things, that seems to me to be neither here nor there. That doesn't at all bear on the question whether it's sensible to believe in God.
Well, we're talking to American philosopher Alvin Plantinger on the program this afternoon. We're going to be continuing in just a moment. Just time to tell you, though, that this series continues the week after next, when I'm going to be joined by Norman Geisler on the program. But Alvin himself, a noted philosopher, and certainly has published many important philosophical papers in regard to the existence of God and some of the questions we've already been talking about. If you want to get in contact today, reflect on anything you've heard on the program, or indeed on previous programs, do get in contact via the usual method. You can get in contact via email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you'd like to get in contact by phone and leave me a voicemail message, you're more than welcome to do that as well. That's 08456 52 52 52, select option 5, and I'll happily play out your voicemail message on the programme next week. And don't forget to visit the webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and check out the previous two programmes we've had, last week with William Lane Craig, and the week before that with Gary Habermas, both keen defenders of the Christian faith, along with Alvin here on the show today. So do get in contact, do listen in, and let's continue the programme this afternoon.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I'd be interested in looking also, Alvin, at the extent of your career. It's obviously, I'm sure, encompassed many a debate with other philosophers. When you have come into contact with other atheist philosophers, what are you hoping to do when you do get into a discussion or into a debate with them? Do you ever think you can actually change someone's mind, or is it about sort of having that sort of intellectual to-ing and fro-ing? What's going on when you do engage in those kind of events?
Well, it's not just a matter of to-ing and fro-ing as if it were a kind of a game of intellectual ping pong or something like that. And also, I don't think, for the most part, by arguing with some mature philosopher, atheist philosopher, I'm going to be able to change his mind. I don't think that's the way it works either. There are two different sides to it here, or two different reasons. One is Christians want to, and should, it seems to me, want to work out what they think about all these different questions, about philosophical questions, about how Christianity is related to science, and how the existence of God is related to the various sorts of questions philosophers ask and answer. So it's a matter of coming to a kind of, intellectual equilibrium, or a kind of trying to understand things from the point of view of Christian belief. And the other part of what makes it important to engage in this kind of thing, another part, is as a matter of defending the faith. People argue against Christianity. People bring these arguments. Christianity is in tough shape in some parts of the world, intellectually speaking, and it's important for Christians to answer these questions and these arguments.
Well, that certainly is the motif for this program. I'm not sure that in the course of the 2.5 years that I've been presenting, I know of many people, many of our non-Christian guests who have been persuaded, but I think that what the discussions have helped to do is help to equip Christians to answer the questions of those who are genuinely searching and haven't, if you like, made their minds up. I do know of a couple, you know, some instances in which people have been persuaded to think differently. But as you say, that's not always the point, I suppose, of what we're actually trying to do. It's been a fascinating discussion with you, Alvin. What, if you like, would you like your legacy to have been when it comes to what your impact on the world? What would you like people to have say, sort of in 50 or 100 years' time? Ah, Alvin Plantinga, he such and such. What would that be?
Well, I guess I'm inclined to think proper modesty ought to prevent one from thinking
much about. Don't be too modest, you know. Sell yourself a bit.
You know, I mean, what I've just been trying to do is, it's not like I've had some grand plan that I conceived when I was 20 years old and have been working it out. What I've been trying to do throughout my philosophical career, for the most part, is defend the Christian faith and develop an answer to various philosophical questions, taking that Christian faith as given.
Mm. Well, there's no doubt that you've done that par excellence, Alvin, and it's been a pleasure chatting with you this afternoon. Before we leave you, for those, if you like, who think, well, I'm not sure I could ever, you know, engage with ideas in on the level that you're obviously used to engaging with them. What would be, if you like, your advice to someone who does want to at least have some kind of ability to engage in philosophical ways with maybe just their neighbour who's asking some of these questions about, where is God when such and such happens? Is there any resource you would point them to? Is there anything, or is it simply sometimes the best option just to pray? I don't know.
Well, it all depends. I mean, if with respect to the, you might say, pastoral or existential problem of evil or other problems in one's life, I don't think philosophy is the main answer there at all. I think praying, as you suggest, is probably a better answer. But there is also this philosophical side of things, defending the faith and the like of that. And for people who are interested in that, I suppose the best thing to do is to start by reading some efforts along those lines, some, say, popular efforts, C.S. Lewis's work, for example, and others. I would think that's the sort of natural thing to do.
What do you think it would take to convince Richard Dawkins to change his mind?
I think it would have to take God's revealing himself to him, God's making known to him that he's there. And, this sort of thing has happened to people before, could happen again, but I don't think any arguments are going to move Richard Dawkins.
I mean, it draws us into another point, I suppose, but if it is God's revealing God's self to people that is the thing that will motivate them to change their mind, to take on a new, you know, in a sense that was, if you like, what happened to St. Paul, if it is that kind of Damascus Road type experience, does that mean that, and that it's in God's hands as to whether someone will turn to God? It's not particularly within our own hands?
I think what it means is, I think it means that God has to offer faith to a person. God makes it possible. God offers himself, but then it's up to. But then I think it's also the case that one can reject this offer. One can turn one's back on God for various reasons. One might not. One of my friends, Thomas Nagel, says, he was a philosopher, Thomas Nagel. He doesn't want there to be such a person as God, and this could be for various sorts of reasons. So I think for one to actually come into this kind of relationship with God, first God has to make this possible, has to make the offer of the gift of faith, and then secondly one has to accept it.
And that acceptance might have to be despite or in spite of one's intellectual doubts. I mean, in the case of Thomas Nagel, obviously an atheist philosopher there, but he wouldn't want the idea of God to be true, of an all-loving, all-powerful, omniscient God. I mean, what do you think Why would he say that? Why would he not want it to be true? Why would he not want to worship a being such as that?
Well, I don't know exactly in his case why he doesn't want that, but there are various reasons. I mean, some people, for example, some people you might say, to put it sort of facetiously, they think it's sort of like an invasion of privacy. There's this great being who knows everything and is privy to my every thought. You know, I can't get away from him. In fact, that sort of thought appears also in Psalm 139. I mean, there are various parts of that psalm, but one part of it almost does border on that. You know, no matter where I go, there God is. I can't get away from him. Can't he leave me alone? I want a little privacy. Mm. And in other cases, well, I mean, if you're serious about God, then you have to do something that's not natural in a certain respect to us human beings. You have to take somebody else to be vastly more important than you are. You have to enlist in somebody else's cause. You know, you can't think of yourself as top dog, not even in your own little universe, and that too can be disturbing.
Was it Bertrand Russell who said, when someone questioned him, what would you do if you stood before God, you know, on the day of judgment? And he said something along the lines of, well, why didn't you give me, I would say to God, why didn't you give me enough evidence to believe in you? I mean, is that a valid sort of thing to be able to say to God? If you are, you know, and I'm sure your atheist philosophical friends, you respect them, you know, that they have really thought through these issues and they've come down on the decision that they don't believe in God. What is left to them that can happen apart from some kind of supernatural revelation of God in their life? Can they say to God, I just didn't have enough evidence to believe in you?
Well, I mean, I guess somebody could say that. That is what Russell said he would say. He'd say, not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence. But I don't know whether, I mean, you might say the same thing about, say, belief in other minds. Suppose there's somebody who just, he's a solipsist, or he thinks there aren't any other persons, there are maybe these other bodies, but he doesn't think there are any other centers of consciousness. People, other beings who actually feel things and have thoughts and the like, you might say, oh, no, well, there's not enough evidence for that. There are these bodies. I see those bodies, but I don't see other minds. And as a matter of fact, there aren't very good arguments for the existence of other minds. But just as it would, it could seem totally foolish to, on that grounds, not accept belief in other minds, so it can seem to me at least totally foolish not to accept belief on God. In God, just on the basis of there not being sufficient evidence. As I say, I think there is this natural inclination in human beings to believe in God, just as there's a natural inclination to believe in other minds. You might think in each case you really do have evidence there, even if there isn't the evidence of arguments from other things you believe.
Well, thank you so much for the time you've devoted, Alvin, to talking to us today. And thank you for the work you're doing and continue to do. Notre Dame, whereabouts in the States is that located, the university where you're currently professor of philosophy?
It's in South Bend, Indiana, which is about 100 miles east of Chicago. You probably know where that is.
I do know where Chicago is, so that gives us a bearing at least of where you're currently practicing. And you're still sort of, do you teach students there? Do you do lectures, that sort of thing?
Yes. I teach mainly graduate students, and I also go around the country and other places giving lectures.
Well, I'm sure that they're benefiting greatly from your years of expertise in the field. And thank you again for joining us on the program today. And if you want to find out more about Alvin, you only have to type his name into the internet, and you'll come up with all kinds of articles. Particularly, of course, Wikipedia is a good place to go. Have you Googled yourself recently, Alvin? Have you found out what people are saying about you?
No, I try not to do too much of that.
Yes, it's always a dangerous thing to do, isn't it?
You
must have read your Wikipedia entry, though, just to check if the facts
right. I have read
that,
yeah. I have read that.
Are you fairly happy that all the details are correct in there?
It's fundamentally right, though, not in every detail.
Okay. well, if you do want to find out a bit more about Alvin, it might be a starting place, though obviously you shouldn't trust everything you see, as I'm sure Alvin would agree. Alvin, thanks very much, and God bless you, and continue the good work.
Thanks, Justin.
It's great to talk to you today. Thanks, and God bless.
Here's what's coming up next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, we'll just be taking a short break from this series in American Masters of Apologetics. The week after next, we'll be meeting our fourth candidate. He is Norman Geisler, who is well known for his work in defending the Bible, among many other things. Next week, we're actually going to be hearing a discussion between Christian Jan Ainsworth and atheist Andrew Copson. They're going to be debating the place of faith schools in society today. Andrew says they have no place in modern society. We live in a multicultural, multi-religious age, and frankly, we should be teaching our children in a neutral environment where no one faith is presented as being correct. Well, we're going to be putting those kinds of questions to Jan, who's our Christian on the show. She is also the Church of England's officer for education, so she knows what she's talking about. And I'm sure it's going to be a really fascinating program next week. Do tune in if you can. Between 2:30 and 4 o'clock. That's the first Saturday of August, I think it'll be. So the summer is really upon us now, isn't it? We're just about halfway through it, I suppose, in many ways. Do hope you have a great rest of the week. Don't forget that Dave and Bea are here next on Premier. Blessings, and thank you for joining me.